Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jamal Abdi, Policy Director with the National Iranian American Council, who assesses the rising tensions between Iran, Israel, and the U.S., and how a new war can be averted. Raquel Goldenberg, co-chair of Rabbis for Human Rights North America, who discusses her group's work both in the U.S. and in Israel. And Jeff Clements, author of the book Corporations Are Not People, who talks about the impact the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision has had on increased spending in the 2012 election campaign. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner filed a complaint with the United Nations over her nation's dispute with Britain regarding the status of the Falkland Islands. 30 years ago, the two nations went to war over the islands, which are located 300 miles off Argentina's coast. Speaking with top government officials and veterans of the 1982 Falklands War, which killed over 900 people, Fernandez condemned Britain for their militarization of the South Atlantic, which implies a great risk to international security. In late January, the British Navy sent a state-of-the-art destroyer, the HMS Dauntless, to patrol the waters off the Falkland Islands, and Prince William was recently deployed to serve with an RAF search and rescue team based in the Falklands. Tensions over the Falklands, known in Argentina as the Malvinas, heated up in 2010 with the discovery of oil reserves near the islands, which are inhabited by only 3,000 people. In February 1982, after Argentina's military seized control of the Falklands, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher sent the Navy to retake the islands in a 10-week war that killed 650 Argentinian soldiers. As the war of words continues, a recent poll found that over 70% of Argentina's public support a policy to regain control over the islands. Parking attendant Hugo Enrique Vera decided to fight back after he was beaten by a wealthy customer in Mexico. Vera filed a lawsuit against his abuser and made a YouTube video which went viral, exposing long-simmering class divisions across Latin America. In Chile, maids and nannies are seeking higher salaries and improved benefits. According to the Christian Science Monitor, a domestic worker in Latin America can earn between $500 and $800 a week as a live-in maid. As a result of recent economic growth in places like Mexico and Brazil, more middle-class couples are seeking domestic workers, but the labor supply is shrinking, allowing workers to demand more for their labor. Public attitudes are changing in Latin American countries as support grows for the rights of domestic workers. In one recent incident, a country club in Chile faced intense criticism for barring nannies with baby carriages from a swimming pool. Rapid growth in Brazil has sent wages for domestic workers soaring and reduced tolerance for abusive behavior by employers. While the number of domestic workers in Rio de Janeiro covered by Social Security has risen by 50%, the children of domestic workers are pursuing higher education and good-paying jobs as nurses and accountants. The Ninth District Federal Court of Appeals in San Francisco overturned Proposition 8, which had banned same-sex marriage in California on narrow legal grounds. The ruling upholds the 2010 District Court decision of Justice Vaughn Walker that concluded Proposition 8 is unconstitutional. The appeals ruling was crafted around the facts of the case rather than on broader constitutional questions, such as the right of gays and lesbians to marry. The decision was written by Judge Stephen Reinhardt in anticipation of an appeal to the more conservative U.S. Supreme Court. In the 2-1 ruling, Reinhardt wrote, "Proposition 8 operates with no apparent purpose but to impose on gays and lesbians through public law a majority's private disapproval of them and their relationships." Proposition 8, which banned gay marriage, was narrowly passed by California voters in 2008 as a constitutional amendment, overturning an earlier state Supreme Court decision legalizing gay marriage. Before Proposition 8 won at the ballot box, an estimated 18,000 same-sex couples were legally married. In 1996, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a Colorado initiative that prevented state and local governments from passing laws protecting the civil rights of gays and lesbians. The majority ruling in the case was written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is predicted to be the swing vote if the overturning of Proposition 8 is eventually heard by the nation's highest court. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Amid rising tensions between Iran and the West, the Israeli government charged that Iran and its ally Hezbollah were responsible for two bombings on February 13th, targeting Israel's embassy staff in New Delhi, India, that injured four, and in Tbilisi, Georgia, where a bomb was found and defused. Three Iranian nationals fled the scene of another bomb explosion in Bangkok, Thailand, on February 14th, that appeared to have been set off accidentally in a house a few miles from the Israeli embassy. Iran has denied any involvement in the attacks. The series of bombings comes after repeated Iranian allegations that Israel was behind the assassinations of five Iranian nuclear scientists, as well as sabotage operations against the Islamic Republic's nuclear research facilities. The U.S., European Union, and Israel have imposed ever harsher economic sanctions on Iran, charging that the nation is covertly working to build a nuclear weapons program, while Iranian officials maintain that their research is for civilian energy production only. Although Israel and the U.S. have talked openly about the option of launching airstrikes to derail Iran's nuclear research program, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta recently told a Senate committee that he doesn't think Israel had yet made a decision on attacking Iran militarily. Your reporter spoke with Jamal Abdi, policy director with the National Iranian American Council. He assesses the rising tensions with Iran and how a new war can be averted.
This is something that we don't know who carried it out, but which I think a lot of us have worried was going to happen inevitably, that there was going to be a response to some of the events that have been happening in Iran carried out by Iran or another proxy group. And it really reflects what the reality of this situation is, in which, you know, the basic law of physics, every action has an opposite reaction. And when just less than a week ago, NBC reported that Israel is actually working with the MEK, the Mujahideen-e Khalq, which is a Iranian exile group. It's designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the United States. It's killed American officials. It's killed Iranians. It came out that they actually worked with the perpetrators of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. They worked with these folks in Iran to commit terrorist attacks. And it came out that Israel was actually working with this group to assassinate nuclear scientists inside of Iran. And I don't think that there's any other definition of killing these people, non-combatants in Iran, other than that it was terrorism carried out by a terrorist group and that Israel apparently was helping them out. So when you see that then there's a reaction to that, there's a response, I think a lot of people thought, this was inevitable, and this is the cycle of confrontation that we continue to see escalating and, you know, this tit-for-tat, and it's leading to a very bad outcome. It's leading to sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that we've been hearing about for so many years now, but which right now looks like it's imminently on the horizon, which is a war with Iran, whether it is a war that starts through an accidental confrontation that escalates out of control, whether it's, you know, the U.S. and Iran getting into some sort of shootout in the Persian Gulf, or it's, you know, Iran doing something in Iraq or in Afghanistan that escalates out of control into war, or if it ends up being Israeli strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities, that is the starting point for just an all-out war between Iran and the U.S.
Jamal, there's a lot of discussion these days about the risk of unintended consequences. And any time you launch a military operation, there is the unknown. We don't know if airstrikes are launched by Israel against Iranian nuclear facilities, whether this will erupt into a full-blown international war or something more localized and less bloody. But there is a concern out there that military strikes are not the way to address these issues and these concerns. From your point of view, How would you like to see the issue of the Iranian nuclear program be addressed in a diplomatic way? There are certainly escalating sanctions against Iran, which seem to have little effect at this point. What are other options that could be employed by President Obama and Congress people and others who have some influence about where we're headed here with what looks like a very dangerous situation?
If you're an Iranian official watching the election showdown between Obama and the GOP right now, and you want to sideline potential diplomacy or you want to urge for Iran to make concessions on the nuclear issue, and then you have folks on the campaign trail, you know, like Newt Gingrich or Rick Santorum saying we should escalate covert actions, and you have Mitt Romney saying if we need to, we're going to go in and bomb Iran, and using this rhetoric to really feed hardliners on both sides who are not interested in taking the steps necessary and really making it so that you can't inoculate this diplomatic track. Now, to answer your question, what I would say is that there does need to be a serious investment in diplomacy that's going to come with some political costs. President Obama, when he was on the campaign trail, he made it clear he really broke from, you know, not only the Bush administration, which said we refuse to negotiate with evil, we're not going to engage in any talks with Iran, but also broke with a lot of his Democratic counterparts on the campaign trail by saying, no, we're the United States, we negotiate with the Soviets when they actually had nuclear weapons, we negotiate with the Chinese when they had nuclear weapons, we can certainly go face-to-face with the Iranians and prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon. But that diplomatic process that he pursued, it lasted for all of a year. He allowed his domestic political opponents here, he allowed his political opponents in Israel, the Netanyahu government that was not in favor of diplomacy with Iran, and he allowed political opponents inside of Iran who were not keen on Ahmadinejad or any of their rivals from getting a deal with the U.S. that could be a success for them at home. And Obama allowed these folks to sort of set the parameters and to say, okay, we're only going to do this for a year, and then we're going back to the sanctions track. And that's the exact same track that the Bush administration was on. And once we got on that track, we haven't found a way to get off. So you have escalating sanctions, you have the covert action, you have this tit for tat, and the room for diplomacy is rapidly dissipating, and there's nobody with the political courage to say, hold on a second, we need to get back to the table. Once you get back to the table, it's a difficult process. Nobody's saying it's going to be a cakewalk. You can actually get to an end game that involves not endless sorties into Iran to bomb nuclear facilities every 3 years and potential all-out war and occupation, but you get to an end game where you say, okay, here is what the UN IAEA needs on the ground, the resources, the access, the transparency that it needs in order to say, without a doubt, Iran's program is purely for civilian purposes. They can't make a nuclear weapon. And we need to get to that point, but we just haven't had the political will and space in order to enter a sustained process that doesn't get hijacked by the need for toughness measures like sanctions and harsh rhetoric. We haven't been able to do that, and we need to get on that track. And it's really a question of, can the president do that before it's too late and we end up at war in the midst of this very tough reelection cycle?
That was Jamal Abdi, policy director with the National Iranian American Council. Find links to more analysis and commentary on the West's reaction to Iran's nuclear program on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Raquel Goldenberg is a rabbi of a congregation in Connecticut and co-chair of Rabbis for Human Rights North America. The organization, founded in 2002, addresses issues of concern in the U.S., such as the torture of American-held prisoners, the rise of Islamophobia, and protecting the rights of farm workers. The group also raises financial support for the Rabbis for Human Rights Israeli chapter. The organization in Israel works to protect Palestinian rights and access to their land in accordance with Israeli Supreme Court decisions, supports the rights of Bedouins living in Israel's Negev desert, opposes evictions and home demolitions of Palestinian families living in East Jerusalem, protects the rights of foreign workers inside Israel, and sponsors educational programs that connect Jewish values to human rights. The group believes in and supports the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, taking a lesson from the Jewish experience during the Nazi Holocaust that the human rights of all who are oppressed must be defended. Rabbi Goldenberg recently spoke at the Joseph Sivka Center for Jewish Life at Yale University. After her talk, she spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus about her work with Rabbis for Human Rights.
They have projects in the territories, specifically in the West Bank, mostly around access of Palestinian farmers to their agricultural land, working with the Israeli military administration to enforce the court rulings that we won a few years ago that protect Palestinian farmers' rights to work their land and to be free from harassment of settlers. So another big project that Rabbis for Human Rights is involved with in Israel is the issue of unrecognized Bedouin villages in the Negev. There's been state policy for many, many years of not recognizing encampments of Bedouin communities that have been in the same place for a very long time. We often think about nomads. We think, oh, they don't really have a place where they live, but they do. They settle in a place, and they establish cemeteries, for instance. So since the founding of the state, this has been an issue with those villages not being recognized, therefore not receiving utilities and schools and other kinds of services in their villages. And then there have been many iterations of different kinds of policies over the years. One was they're called by the human rights community really townships, towns set up, but they say townships because that evokes poverty and slum, and that's what they are. Towns set up where the government would then put the Bedouins, where they have no place to graze their animals and, you know, have
so
become,
they're forcibly
so
removed.
They're forcibly removed, yes. There's different levels of force, right? I mean, if you're not getting the services you need and you're not getting, it's hard to get your kids to school because you don't have a school in your community, it's easier then maybe to move to one of these slums where
they provide schools in the slums?
Yes. Yes. I mean, these are recognized towns that have everything. You know, they have utilities, they have paved roads, they have schools. But it means that the heritage of Bedouin life and their roots are being uprooted.
To ask the obvious, I guess, if these people have been there all the time since before the State of Israel was created and then Israel was created and they're still there, they're among the Arab Israelis and other Arab Israelis have services and schools and everything. Why haven't these been recognized?
We don't really know, right? I mean, there are interests. It's not in the interest of the state. There have been various reasons given over the years. You know, they'll say it's a closed military zone, or they'll say maybe it's to make way for other kinds of development and other kinds of planning. It's hard to say.
The other thing that I think has been in the news a lot here is issues around the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, especially, you know, demanding that women, you know, basically not be seen or move away from the ultra-Orthodox men. They were men in the military who left some kind of a gathering when women started to sing because they said they weren't allowed to hear a woman's voice and all this stuff. So how does that play out in Israel, I guess, and also in the Jewish community here when you work with your Rabbis for Human Rights here?
Rabbis for Human Rights does not deal directly with issues of religious pluralism in Israel. So there are other wonderful organizations that do. The Israel Religious Action Center and the New Israel Fund, for instance. It's really an issue of religious extremism in the Jewish community in Israel. And that even, you know, the ultra-Orthodox, we can't generalize and say that they all actually agree with these policies of segregation of the sexes, just like you can't say that all Muslims agree with veiling women from head to toe. It's really an extremist group that intimidates its own people. If you live in that community, which is a very insular, self-regulated community, and you speak out against segregation of the sexes, your kids could be kicked out of yeshiva. You could be told the community will cut you off, or you can't live in your apartment anymore. I mean, truly, kind of breaking away from the fold in any kind of public way is dangerous. It's risky. So that's sort of how the extremists operate in that community through this kind of intimidation. There are moderates in that community. There are people in that community who disagree with the rabbis and the extremists who are making these policies. They're having a hard time safely making their voices heard.
That was Raquel Goldenberg, co-chair of Rabbis for Human Rights North America. Learn more about the group by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Although President Obama opposed the Supreme Court's January 2010 Citizens United decision that eliminated many limits on corporate contributions to election campaigns, he symbolically threw in the towel in early February to endorse super political action committees, or super PACs, created by the decision. With his endorsement, Obama joined Republican presidential candidates who are already using super PACs and urged his supporters to make donations to the Priorities USA super PAC established to make unlimited expenditures on the president's behalf in the 2012 campaign. But as the White House made this announcement, a press release stated that the president favors action, by constitutional amendment if necessary, to place reasonable limits on all such spending. In response to the Citizens United decision that opened the floodgates to record amounts of unlimited and anonymous corporate campaign cash, a number of national groups are campaigning to overturn the High Court decision. Activists are gathering petition signatures and urging the passage of resolutions at the city and state level in support of an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would reverse the court's declaration in Citizens United that corporations have the same rights as living natural persons. Your reporter spoke with Jeff Clements, co-founder and general counsel with the Free Speech for People campaign and author of the book Corporations Are Not People, Why They Have More Rights Than You Do, and What You Can Do About It. Here he talks about the impact the Citizens United decision has had on increased spending in the 2012 election campaign and the grassroots effort to reverse that decision and strengthen democracy.
The corporate spending and secret spending and massive spending by billionaires and millionaires in the federal races since Citizens United decided, and in state races, although there's less data on that, has just been extraordinary. It's leaped by multiple factors. So in 2010, the midterm elections, it was the first election after Citizens United, and it was the most expensive election in American history. $4 billion was spent in various races, totaling, and at least hundreds of millions of those dollars came from sources that we're not really sure where the money came from and whether it's corporate money or not corporate money. And the sad thing is, despite that massive expenditure and the corrupting influence of the corporate money in that election, 60% of eligible voters did not bother to vote. We're now seeing much worse in the 2012 election, in the primaries already, and we'll see it'll get worse to come. And we're starting to get data on it that shows that the vast, vast majority, upwards of 97% of the super PAC money in the Republican primaries, and Obama's going to use a super PAC too, but 97% of Romney's super PAC, for example, of the money that comes into that comes in increments of greater than $10,000. So that isn't a super PAC that's collecting money from interested citizens. We know that some of the money, again, it's hard because there's no disclosure requirement, so there are technical disclosure requirements for super PACs, but they're easily evaded. So we only know pieces of it, but we know that big energy companies like Alpha, the Global Coal Corporation, is putting money into super PACs like American Crossroads. We know that News Corporation and other corporations put money into both the 2010 election and the current election. So it has had an immediate impact on the elections, no question.
Jeffrey, after a century of precedent on the Supreme Court in this country to keep large amounts of corporate cash out of our election campaigns, how is it that this Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, overturned that precedent? There has been speculation that the Roberts Court has had undue influence by the billionaire Koch brothers and others who've wined and dined them and had them at special secret meetings. Is there any validity to those theories? And what do you think really is happening that has dramatically changed our campaign finance law?
You know, the validity to those particular concerns, I think there's some validity, but I would put it in the larger context. The problem is corporate influence at all levels. It's corporate influence, corporate power assertion throughout our government. And unfortunately, sadly, it has affected our judiciary too. But I think we would miss the real story if we just looked for a connection to the Koch brothers, for instance. Because Citizens United, in my view, and the story I tell in the book, is it's really the end game of a sustained, very well-funded corporate campaign to twist the Constitution and take rights in order to undermine democracy. I think it goes back to 1970 or so when Lewis Powell famously wrote what's called the Powell Memo. It was secret at the time to the Chamber of Commerce, advising that corporations do exactly this. He went on the Supreme Court. He wrote at least four decisions creating the notion, something called corporate speech, which had never existed in American history. He built a majority for this doctrine, and it has been used well before Citizens United to strike down environmental laws, public health laws, worker protection laws, financial regulation. In that sense, if you look at it from sort of that long view of corporations creating by sustained litigation, filing of briefs, funding of legal foundations, funding of, I'd say, corporatist more than conservative judicial doctrine, Citizens United is almost the logical next step. If corporations have rights to strike down all these other laws, then election law is even more important if you have constitutional rights, and the logic is impeccable. It's also catastrophically wrong.
Jeff, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the effort underway now to overturn the Citizens United decision in this unlimited and unaccountable corporate cash coming into our campaign finance system, what is the most direct and, in your view, the way that could be most successful in overturning that Supreme Court decision?
Well, the most important thing is to challenge the constitutional distortion, the fabrication that the case has created. And the way those kind of disputes are resolved in America is through the constitutional amendment process. So that process will need two-thirds of vote of Congress at some point. We'll need three-quarters of the states to ratify it. But in the meantime, by driving that amendment conversation, we need the People's Rights Amendment, we need the amendment to overturn the idea as well that money is speech. We need to do it everywhere, cities and towns doing resolutions. That's happening right now all over the country. It's happening with a lot of different groups, and I think that's the key, is we need to not sort of argue too much about what the exact language is. We'll get that in terms of the amendment. There'll be a good debate. There's plenty of versions of them pending in Congress right now, but we need to do all of the resolution campaigns in cities, towns, states. So I wish I had a nice, easy answer that there's only one thing you have to do, but actually we have to do all of those things.
That was Jeff Clements, co-founder and general counsel with the Free Speech for People campaign and author of the book Corporations Are Not People. Find more information on the grassroots campaign to overturn the Citizens United decision on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There, you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.